We continue now with The Virtue of Trust. Chapter 15, Trust in Desolation. The Importance of Desolation. This world in which we live our brief lives has ever been for all of us, whether good or evil, whether saints or sinners, an earthly exile, a valley of tears. At every step we meet suffering in every shape. It is, however, a suffering reserved for souls leading the interior life, for those souls who are the friends of Jesus. This suffering embraces the spiritual barrenness, numbness, and aridity which we know under the general term of desolations. They are caused by the seeming absence of God and His grace. Those alone know desolation who have known consolation, for those alone know how dull and sad is life without Jesus, who have known the sweetness and delight of His presence. We have all experienced these spiritual ordeals, sighing wistfully for the return of the Beloved. The soul has no sooner crossed the threshold of the interior life, and by virtue of the consolations and the proved delights of God, has no sooner in some measure detached itself from this world, then from time to time God hides Himself from it. He gives it to taste of the bitter yet salutary medicine of desolation, that He may forthwith detach the soul from the self and from spiritual joys. God's end is only attained when the soul, having climbed through the dark storm clouds, has reached the dazzling peak of holiness, and knows at last the unclouded sunshine of its transforming union with God. Desolation, therefore, has an important place in the spiritual life. It is vital that we shall see it in its right perspective, to the end that in desolation we shall order our lives according to God's will. Alas, it is peculiarly in desolation that our trust seems to grow faint. Let us now consider other spiritual ordeals. When we know consolation in particular, it is sweet to suffer for Jesus and easy to perceive in God's crosses the ways of love and to bless Him for them. Yet, when faith and love seem to have forsaken our souls, when we appear to be utterly alone, given over to sadness and to melancholy, it is then that the whole face of the earth seems changed. In the dusk and the oncoming night which surrounds us, the merest trifles assume fantastic proportions, take upon themselves the most frightening aspects. Our hearts contract and we are tempted to believe that Jesus has forsaken us, or at least that His love for us has grown cold. The virtue which it brings to blossom. If we make good use of our desolations and of our aridities, how quickly we shall begin to tread the path of perfection. How we shall profit from the inexhaustible treasure of these rich mines. Of loving souls, it might be said that barrenness and desolation are a true nursery of virtue. In it, God cultivates with great care, humility, trust, love of the cross, hate of ourselves, perfect love of God. Without the wide choice which we have between various consolations and desolations, we could never realize at all clearly our inherent and essential helplessness. When conscious grace is withdrawn, our soul needs to have repeated experience of its poverty, its weakness, and its lack of generosity, that it may reach an approximate perception of its own true nature and of the debt which it owes to God. When in hours of meditation it has felt itself enkindled and enraptured by the power of His love, and when a few hours later it is conscious of ill humor, is sated with suffering, it is made more thoroughly aware of its spiritual poverty than by the best of its meditations. Further, what shall be said of the contrast known to those many favored souls who have known the presence of God and the gift of contemplation? At the day's beginning came the joyful hour of dawn, radiant with exquisite light, glorious beneath the morning star, redolent with the perfume of the fragrant presence of Jesus. At the day's end, Jesus has withdrawn himself. The sweet consciousness of his presence has yielded to the desolation of solitude. To the soul, it seems that it has never loved Jesus, and that likewise, Jesus has never loved it. All this, nevertheless, is but a trifle in comparison with those terrifying desolations which last for years, and through which pass all souls who are upon the brink of the mystical life, which are known as the night of the senses. The latter, in its turn, bears no comparison with that no less enduring and still more purifying ordeal which leads mystical souls to holiness, and which is known as the night of the spirit. We shall deal with this at length in a later chapter. Like that holy man Job, the soul finds itself steeped in bitter suffering, for it is this earth becomes purgatory. Moreover, all these, whether they be the desolations of an hour or the ordeals of several years, are the work of God performed secretly in us, which no reflection, no meditation, no resolution could secure us. It is God himself working to give us true and profound humility, who frees us forever from the tyranny of the self, and who once and for all rids us of the folly of pride and makes our own the gifts of the Savior. So only we are wistful of humility, let us give loving welcome to these blessed ordeals of desolation that a very manure heap of God gives vigorous life to the fine plant of humility. Humility is the elder sister of trust. Therefore, it is not astonishing to see the trust of generous souls grow rapidly in the soil of aridity and of desolation. Souls of poor spirituality lose the little trust that they had. Accordingly, God ordinarily spares them, sending them desolation, but rarely. Yet for the loving soul that desires to manifest its love and its trust in Jesus, desolations are friends. They give it that ability to trust in Jesus, which is its joy at those hours when everything conspires to fill it with distrust. Our human nature is indolent, sad of heart, attracted by material advantages and exterior joys. Jesus seems to concern himself with us no more. It is then that we cry to Jesus, "O my beloved, I know that now and always you love me. Now and always I believe in your love. Despite my poverty and my misery, I trust in you. It is your will to see the extent of my trust in you. O Jesus, with your grace, I will endure to the end. Till you shall come to me, I will hold firm to my belief." Ah, these dear desolations of devoted souls that bring to Jesus the sweet incense of so many acts of pure trust and comfort him for so much mistrust on the part of souls whose fervor burns less brightly. From trust to surrender, there is but a single step. There is no more valuable spiritual ordeal to teach us to surrender ourselves wholly to God. In consolation, all goes well. We are aware of the progress which we are making upon the path of perfection. The sun shines. The way is wide and direct and straight. But now, the trees branch overhead. There is no road. Only a maze of tracks remain. There is desolation. We are as men who have no compass. We seem to be traveling in a circle. We continue to rely upon the self for guidance. This is the hour preferred above all hours by souls surrendered to God. They trust themselves blindly to the divine guide who has brought them to the forest and who has expert knowledge of the path known to him alone, which shall lead them out of it. To the surrendered soul that desires to win through love to self-forgetfulness, what more exquisite joy is there than thus blindly to follow the Master who leads it to union? That it may attain to more complete self-forgetfulness, it prefers to know nothing of the paths which Jesus follows, of the stages which it has passed, and which it has yet to reach. What precise point it has attained upon the road to perfection, it zealously avoids even the wish to know. Were it so much as to wish to lift the concealing curtain, it would lose the intimate and hidden joy which makes complete self-forgetfulness possible. "I am the plaything, the little ball of the child Jesus," said that great disciple of surrender, the little Teresa of the child Jesus. "The divine child can do with me what he wills, can play to his heart's content with his little ball, can amuse himself as he thinks proper. While if it gives him pleasure to stick pins in me or to put me in the corner, my happiness shall persist, for the very reason that it is his good pleasure." Indeed, she had a decided preference for desolations, since in them, rather than in consolation, she knew the delightful though unperceived joy not only of pleasing Jesus, but of pleasing him at cost to herself, of pleasing him at cost to her own pleasure. To complete a bunch of flowers which we have gathered on the bleak rocks of desolation, that lovely flower of charity, the queen of virtues, needs now to be mentioned. For it too grows freely amid the boulders and the brambles of these spiritual ordeals, so many kinds of which exist. One of the most beautiful of them is love of suffering. True love of God cannot live without suffering. We are well aware of this, and more than once have proved it for ourselves. Now what more profitable suffering is there than that which detaches us from life's keenest delight, the delight which comes of consciousness of God's love? Other spiritual ordeals detach us from joys of the senses, from riches, from reputation, from health. Desolation detaches us from these good things that, good materially, are not necessarily good spiritually. It is hard on God's account to forsake our riches, our pleasures, our friends, and ourselves. It is still harder for the soul which has forsaken all things for God, in a measure also to surrender God. Desolation is exile, exile not from our fatherland or from our parents. It is exile no less sorrowful to a soul ahungered of God, exile from God himself, our all, whose dear and delightful presence we surrender out of love for himself. It is that kind of exile which, if it be prolonged or intensified, can become a true martyrdom. Let us then love this ordeal that gives us such notable opportunities to show our love for Jesus and our desire to suffer for him. If it be true that we cannot practice great austerities, we can certainly suffer, generously and trustingly suffer, desolation. We can thus manifest to Jesus the fervor and purity of our love more convincingly than by many other spiritual crosses. There is another variety of this fine flower of charity, an exquisite variety whose name is joy in the soul's insignificance and in its poverty. Those souls that have made some progress upon the way of pure love are well acquainted with this flower that others neglect. When they are conscious of themselves as weak, lacking in generosity, repulsive, even hideous, it is then that they find a particular delight in loving their poverty, in rejoicing in this manifestation of misery and even of faults. To them it is a joy to exult in displaying what insignificant and sinful creatures they are. And the reason for this? The reason is that pure love of God is necessarily hatred of self. The obverse of the coin of pure love is self-scorn. Here again is the reason why the happiness which comes of pure love has distinct constituent parts. the joy of marveling at and of loving as though they were its own, the enrapturing perfections of God and of Jesus, the equal joy of holding in hatred and in horror as though it were a stranger and an enemy, the supreme ugliness of the self. The loving soul feeds on this double joy. It gives us happiness to discover ourselves so ugly, so inherently imperfect, so evilly inclined, to declare that the once so greatly loved self that has now become our great enemy and the enemy of God is utterly odious, in that its very repulsiveness sets in still greater relief the ineffable perfections of God. We have cast from us, as though it were a verminous garment, this scoundrelly self, the former object of our complacency. Henceforth we find all our joy in the infinite lovableness of God, now become our new self. It is for this reason that all which humbles the self, our old-time tyrant and seducer, has for us become a source of secret joy. Our fervent love of God makes us glad at heart to see our common enemy unmasked, to perceive his repulsiveness so completely discovered that we no longer need to fear seduction by his deceiving charms. How pure and beautiful an expression of love for God is this love of our misery and of our poverty, this love which is known solely to the initiated, to those souls to whom God has revealed these mysteries. How far from commonplace is this love of our repulsiveness that enables us strangely to find our happiness where so many spiritual souls find only sadness and discouragement. St. Francis de Sales loved to speak of this mysterious joy brought by love of our debasement. St. Teresa of the Child Jesus has written delightfully of it. It was she who wrote, quote, "Many weaknesses have been mine, yet in them I rejoice. It is dear delight to know oneself weak and insignificant." Unquote. Here, then, is that pure love which desolation so often gives us the opportunity of practicing. Were it to produce but this flower that is a hybrid of love and of humility, desolation would be dear indeed to us, would make us as dear to Jesus, the gardener of our soul. Let us not seldom ask for this mighty and availing grace that alone can reveal to us the mysterious joy of despising the self for love's sake, this joy that more than all things shall contribute to killing the old Adam in us. The joy which comes of love is not always conscious. The objection will perhaps be raised that though in theory, doubtless, desolation can be for all of us an opportunity for many virtuous deeds performed, yet in practice, the effect of desolation is precisely to make us unable to do such deeds, or at best, to do them with no joyous heart. The joy of self-abandonment, the joy of suffering, the joy of self-forgetfulness for Jesus' sake, the joy of self-scorn, all these may be possible in consolation, but certainly not in desolation. From the outset, let us not confuse the joy of the senses with that joy which is happiness, as true and as deep as it is hidden and imperceptible. In spiritual barrenness, we do not know, it is plain, the conscious joy of loving Jesus by reason of our self-abandonment, our suffering, or our self-forgetfulness. Yet we can most certainly know peace at our heart's core and the inner satisfaction of our gift of self. Moreover, the greater the advance we make in the ways of the Spirit, the greater is the detachment we achieve in the things of the senses, and the greater, too, our ability to penetrate the most secret recesses of our soul, there to have knowledge of the peace and unconscious happiness of pure love. A more serious difficulty, however, is this: how, without conscious joy, to make specific acts of love for God, acts of resignation, and so forth, is either wholly or almost wholly beyond our knowledge. our mind grows blank. Our heart grows heavy within us. Consciously, to perform any act that shall make plain either our love of God, of resignation, or of trust, seems to us compact of pain indeed. A great weight seems to press upon our soul. Yet it is true that one such act performed to the best of our ability, as opportunity offers, is infinitely pleasing to God. Moreover, the performance of such an act is simplicity itself. It needs but an aspiration, a becoming inclination of the heart, a single sigh of the soul. Direct acts of the soul that are infinitely precious. If even this be difficult, if we be unable often to make such acts because of the pain with which they are fraught, let us reflect that there are acts which are not reflex, the direct acts of our soul. Of these we have little or no consciousness. God alone, who knows us better than we know ourselves, perceives them hidden in the depths of our soul, and unknown to us, is by them made exceedingly glad of heart. These hidden, secret, and altogether spontaneous acts the soul performs almost perpetually. Does a loving mother, who watches with admirable devotion over her sick child, love him only when she heaps him with kisses and caresses? The truth is that there is no intermission in her unspoken love. Ceaselessly she gives herself to the dear child over whom she keeps vigil. Her sadness and anxiety are both the consequence and the proof of her unvarying love of him. The mere look of agony which she gives the child is in itself an act of love, a direct, not a reflex act. In desolation, this holds true of ourselves. To be sad because of our love for him at the absence of Jesus, to no aspiration for him, is an act of love that gushes without ceasing from our heart as a full spring from the side of a hill. There's no doubt that Jesus has all the joy with which these acts are instinct. The living water brings refreshment to him, but not to ourselves. Yet does this matter? Better still, with trust to surrender ourselves, to believe in his love despite all things, carefree and of our own will to fall asleep as though we slept in the arms of Jesus, does not this involve an unbroken succession of direct, not reflex, acts of loving abandonment? While if from time to time we perform an act of love that is both explicit and reflex, this act will be like the kiss which the child gives his mother, the kiss which is but the more demonstrative expression of that love which enables him to sleep peacefully at his mother's breast. Whatever the ways by which God leads us, whether of desolation on the one hand or of consolation on the other, we can be certain that each day of our life will be rich in acts meritorious in God's sight. Gaze upon these ripe fields with their million heavy wheat ears waving in the wind. It is God who has had each of these blades in his care, and not merely these blades, but each of their many grains which his love has brought into being, that we may have food. Shall not God, who has infinitely more solicitude for our souls ransomed by the blood of Jesus, make it his care to have them produce the blades of virtuous acts? If we be fervent, the most apparently empty of our days, whether these be days of desolation, days of weakness, or days of sickness, are full of these golden blades, which are our acts of virtue, whether direct or reflex. Our sole care must be in no way to pander to our vanity, for vanity also has as many direct acts as virtue. In the field of our soul it mingles with those blades that are heavy with their riches of divine love, all too many barren blades, blades of self-love. How much happier we should be in desolation if we had greater consciousness of the value of our direct acts, of these states of soul that give it its true orientation towards God, of which our reflex acts are only a clearer expression, but no whit more meritorious for that. Our one need is this, of our own will to renounce the pleasure which our acts bring us, that conscious and perceptible pleasure which comes of our reflex acts. We must know how to surrender the conscious joy which we have of our virtues, that all this joy may appertain to Jesus. And this is no easy thing. It implies much self-abnegation and self-forgetfulness. It needs much love. Such joy, to be renounced that its activity may be experienced. It is for this reason that spiritual desolation is so precious. It makes the self die more completely within us. To our vanity, consciousness of our own activity, and the knowledge that we are responsible of many virtuous acts brings delight. The secret self-satisfaction which pervades us is an intoxicating wine that leaves us reeling with delicious ecstasy. Therefore, we need not one, but hundreds of desolations, of periods of spiritual barrenness and of seeming inactivity, that we may be rid of this cursed self-complacency. To tear this weed from our soul, we need not once but many times to realize the impossibility of performing acts of virtue, whether interior or exterior, to realize equally the seeming uselessness of our contemplations and our spiritual indolence in general, that this weed may be destroyed, that we may the more thoroughly slay the self-will in us. Jesus is prepared even to allow us visible faults, to permit us to know minor humiliating lapses and infidelities that may serve the good of our souls. He counts nothing too much if it extirpate this persistent manifestation of our self-love. In desolation, he often takes from us the joy of realizing our activity and the progress which we've made, and with it our consciousness of the acts of virtue performed by us. What happiness we should know in thinking that the joy which he takes from us makes glad his own heart. At his leisure, he takes delight in all these countless direct acts of love, of trust, of humility, of self-surrender, of which, in the midst of our spiritual ordeals, our heart is the visible theater. I can always be well-pleasing to Jesus. If we are truly wistful of love, wistful of self-surrender, and of self-forgetfulness for Jesus' sake, what more do we need to be happy in desolation? Upon this earth, what is, what should be, our one desire? It is the ability to please Jesus greatly, and with Jesus, God, whom we love. This is the desire which is absolutely and unconditionally ours, the desire to which we have some measure of right, the desire which Jesus does not ask us to sacrifice to himself. All but this he can ask from us. He can ask from us the sacrifice of a particular kind of life, of a particular kind of grace, of a particular director of our choice, of a particular apostolate, of some seeming success in our own spiritual life or in that of souls directed by us. He can ask from us the sacrifice of this or the other spiritual consolation, of this or that plan for holiness. Never will he ask that we shall sacrifice to him that supreme joy of the loving soul, the joy of pleasing him greatly, utterly. For this joy is equally the supreme joy of his divine heart. He yearns to make it ours. How then shall he refuse it to us? How then will he take it away? Do you then rejoice, O loving soul, whose unique desire is to please the divine master? Whatever plan God may have for you, whatever the way by which he leads you, whether in desolation or in consolation, you can please Jesus, can please him utterly. To give pleasure to this dear master is the very breath of our soul. Without that breath, you could not live. Jesus knew this well. To please Him, one thing only is necessary. Do your utmost. Do your best. Give Jesus all your goodwill. This you can always do, even in the midst of the blackest desolations. In simplicity of soul, you can always do your utmost. At such hours, in naked faith, you can abandon yourself blindly to His love. At such hours, Jesus asks no more of you than this. He is too reasonable to demand the impossible. Oh, with what transcendent peace, this sweet conviction that you are at all times able to give Jesus pleasure and to bring Him joy must inspire your soul. How this conviction must simplify and unify your whole life. Now and forever, despite all vicissitude and superficial change, in the depth of your heart, the same intimate, calm, and profound happiness can establish itself unassailably. That happiness of giving pleasure to Jesus, Himself, the unique treasure of your heart. This, even when the contrary seems true. It does not follow that this happiness will always be a conscious happiness, a happiness that the soul can relish with delight. Certainly not. Such a happiness is calculated solely and inevitably to feed our vanity with egoistic enjoyment. In most cases, this happiness is a happiness relating to the spirit and in no way to the senses, a happiness whose sanctuary is to be found in the most secret of the secret recesses of our soul, a happiness of which we are wholly unconscious. It is nonetheless real for this. As we've previously said, Jesus will never ask us for the sacrifice of that supreme happiness of every loving soul, the happiness of pleasing Him utterly. Nevertheless, at first sight, it would seem that we are mistaken. It is not rarely that we know those particularly agonizing and often prolonged ordeals in which not only do we lack the conscious joy of being able to please Jesus, but in which we have the keen and bitter consciousness of no longer pleasing Him or even of displeasing Him. Jesus seems to have turned His back upon us. What great grief lies in this! What overwhelming doubt! What good purpose does our life serve if it be no longer pleasing in His sight? For what is the aim of our life but to permit Jesus to live in us and through us, to give Him cause for rejoicing? Of what use are sacrifices, our austerities, if they be no longer pleasing to Jesus? If they no longer bring Him joy? For then the sweet incense of our love and of our devotion no longer ascends to God. Poor, forsaken soul, even then have trust, now and forever have trust. Believe, despite all things, that you are pleasing to Jesus, that you are altogether pleasing to Him. In your secret soul, does not something tell you that Jesus loves you as of old, that you remain as pleasing in His eyes, as pleasing as you were in those former hours of loving intimacy? Cling to this secret conviction of your soul as the unheard-of voice of Jesus. In the past, has trust in God ever failed you? Nor will it fail you now. When the storm is past, and when all is calm in and about you, the sweet voice of Jesus makes itself heard clearly anew, bidding you know how infinitely pleasing it is your blind trust to Him. Recall our Lord's words to St. Catherine of Siena. After temptation had assailed her violently, she cried to Him, "O God, where are you now?" "In your own heart," replied Jesus. We are not to confuse the joy of giving pleasure with the joy of knowing that we give pleasure. We must not then confuse the joy of pleasing Jesus and of rejoicing His divine heart with that other joy of knowing that we please Him or of being conscious of the fact. We can always be well pleasing in the sight of Jesus if we wish it, but we shall not always have the conviction and consciousness of it. There are times indeed when we have the contrary conviction, when in this matter we know cruel doubt, This is always the case in the night of the senses and in the night of the spirit. Yet, if our love be truly pure and our trust truly unassailable, all things despite, we shall believe that we shall please him, while it shall be our joy to sacrifice for Jesus our conscious delight in it. What matters it ultimately if we seek only the joy of Jesus? What matters it whether or not I feel and know that I'm pleasing to Jesus? So only I please him, so only he be happy, the rest matters nothing. It is not my joy, but his that I desire, and I'm ready to sacrifice for him even this beneficent and noble joy of knowing that I please him, if this be the requirement of his good pleasure. Saint Teresa of the Child Jesus expressed this delightfully. Writing during her novitiate to the Mother Agnes of Jesus, she said, quote, "Of Jesus ask that I may love him disinterestedly. So only Jesus be conscious of it. I do not desire myself to be conscious of my love for him. That Jesus be aware of my love is all I ask." Unquote. On another occasion, she wrote to her sister, quote, "Your little daughter has heard little of heaven's vast music. The course of her nuptials has been an arid course. Yet do not imagine that this leaves her sad of heart. This is far from being the case. It is her joy to go whither her betrothed goes, for his own sake and not for the sake of his gifts. In himself he is beautiful. He is rapturously beautiful. Though he keep silence, though he hide himself from my eyes, yet his rapturous beauty remains." Unquote. We are to love the God of consolations and not the consolations of God. How utterly we are deceived by this impression, known to us in spiritual aridity, of our inability to please Jesus, due to the fact that we grow spiritually numb and that we no longer know conscious love. As has already been shown, desolation permits us to perform countless acts, direct or reflex, it matters not which, of profound humility, of blind trust, of love of suffering, of mortification of the self. It gives us, therefore, countless opportunities of pleasing Jesus and of bringing him joy. In particular, it gives us the great advantage of being able to love Jesus with a pure and disinterested love. It is sadly true that in consolation we are tempted to love ourselves and in ourselves to put our trust. We are aware of the wings which consolation gives us, and upon them we rely. We are conscious of the joy of love, and we all but forget to love God in our love of the dear delight which we have in his love. In desolation, it is far otherwise. Then, if we persist in our love has no other goal than God. No longer do we love God for the sake of his gifts, of which we are no longer conscious. We love him purely for his own sake. In this way, we detach ourselves from the consolations of God, that we may attach ourselves to the God of consolations. That alone should give us a preference for desolations and spiritual aridities. If we be desirous of loving Jesus with a pure love, we ought to welcome with glad hearts these excellent opportunities for practicing this love that Jesus himself has chosen for us. Doubtless, this is no easy thing. This is all to the good. The more we advance in love, the more we shall delight in these opportunities for pure love. Teresa said, "Let us love Jesus sufficiently to be willing to suffer all that he would have us suffer, though it be aridities and numbness of the soul." If we have a great love of loving Jesus and make no demand to experience that love's sweetness, this is great love indeed. This is love's very martyrdom. Then let us die love's martyrs. What delight we should give the heart of Jesus were we to love him in desolation with a loving trust. You who would be a faithful friend of Jesus, bringing him solace for all those who do not love him, set your vanity to love him in times of spiritual barrenness, in those times when this is the will of Jesus also. Make it your happiness to love him upon Calvary no less than upon Thabor. Love him with a pure love, not wholly on behalf of those who fail to love him or of those who actually offend him, but still more on behalf of those countless souls whose love for him is poor and weak, who love themselves more than they love him. Goodwill, an act of love ever and everywhere, and nothing more, this henceforth is my program. It is for Jesus to take care for the rest, to love God, to love him at my own cost, to love him without enjoying, to love him in suffering, to love him in weariness, dryness, darkness, doubts, scruples, temptations, somber visions of the future. Such shall be my lot, as my Master shall will it. I know that he's good, I know that he loves me, I believe in his love. And to love thee thus, O my dear Master, delights me. To enjoy thee I have an eternity, but to cause thee to enjoy my love through suffering and immolation, I have only my short existence here. Then take from my substance, O my Master, all that it contains, and is able to yield to the glory of thy name. Draw from it abundantly, so that when I come to die, I may have become wholly thine. Let us continue with the virtue of trust on side B.